The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Hanukkah and the Maccabee Revolt, is dedicated to the memory and Ilui Nishmas Yitzchak Ben Zerach, Olav Shalom, Mr. Irving Kirzner of blessed memory.
To Jews, history is not merely a faint memory of a distant past, but a living presence day in and day out. In the morning service, as part of the Psukei de Zimra, the verses of Scripture that are said before Shema, we recite the Shira, the great detailed song of victory over the Egyptians at the Red Sea. Twice a day, at the end of the recitation of the Shema, we thank God for delivering us from slavery in Egypt. We recall Makas Bechoros, the smiting of the firstborn, as well as the parting of the Red Sea and the defeat of the forces of Pharaoh. The key events surrounding the founding of the Jewish people are constantly repeated in detail, day in and day out. Our history, of course, did not end with the Exodus. It only began. Not only was our creation a miracle, but so is our ongoing survival. And of this, too, we make mention every day. Every morning we say, Ezras avoseinu atahu me'olam, mogen moshiach levnehem achareihem, b'chol dor v'dor. The helper of our forefathers are you alone forever, shield and savior for their children after them in every generation. And every night we affirm, Hapoideinu miyad malochim, malkeinu hagoaleinu mikav kol ha'aretzim. He redeems us from the power of kings, our King who delivers us from the hand of all cruel tyrants. The identity of those cruel tyrants and how our survival was affected is generally left to historical record and oral tradition. It is only alluded to in our prayers in general terms. Twice a year, however, we make an exception, express in greater detail our survival. The first time is on Hanukkah, when we celebrate our victory over Antiochus and the Greeks and thank God for our continued spiritual survival. The next time is on Purim, when we celebrate our victory over Haman and thank God for our continued physical survival. In truth, though, both holidays represent another victory of sorts. According to tradition, the Jewish people were destined to become subjugated by four major powers. First Babylon, next Persia, then Greece, and finally Rome. Our present state of exile is understood to be a continuation and a modern-day form of Roman domination. Purim and Hanukkah is the celebration of our victories over Persia and Greece. That's number two and number three. Tisha B'Av, the anniversary of the destruction of the first and second temples, is a commemoration of our defeat by Babylon and Rome. That's number one and number four. One day soon, with the coming of Moshiach, we hope to commemorate the end of the entire Golus, the entire exile of the Jewish people, and celebrate the ensuing victory over all those that have persecuted us. The story of these four powers, again, one Babylon, two Persia, three Greece, four Rome, their role in Jewish history, its impact today, and how it all fits in with Hanukkah is the subject of tonight's lecture. I know my wife wants me to keep all of this very short. One of the major themes of the Torah is the theme of bris, or covenant. There's the bris milah, the covenant of the circumcision. There's the bris of Torah, or accepting the Torah in the Sinai Desert, and Arvos Moav on the plains of Moav. The first bris, however, between God and the Jews was the bris Bein HaBesorim, the covenant that promised the Jewish people the land of Israel. That promise, however, came with severe terms. The Jews would have to undergo years of servitude before they would become sufficiently purified to merit living on a permanent basis in the holiest of all lands, Israel. Ideally, the Jews should have experienced total purification through their enslavement in Egypt. That would have taken a full 400 years of enslavement. Although the Jews underwent the indignity of being strangers or alien residents for 400 years, beginning with the birth of Yitzchak, of Isaac, the Jews were only in Egypt for 210 years and only severely enslaved for 86. But the Jews did not have the luxury of waiting in Egypt for 400 years of being slaves. They were rapidly becoming affected by the pagan and immoral environment of Egypt. According to Kabbalistic sources, the Jews had not left. When they did, they would have become so contaminated, they would have been beyond redemption. That is why we make mention at the Pesach Seder of God's kindness, calculating the 400 years of purification from the birth of Isaac rather than the enslavement in Egypt. We were redeemed early, but at a high cost. The purification that began in Egypt would have to be completed through other foreign powers, hence the need for the Jews to become subjugated by the four world powers, again, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. In fact, as we quote in our handout on page 3, which we're going to get to soon, the Arba Goluyos, these four exiles, were alluded to in the Bris Ben Abisorim, the covenant that promised us the land of Israel. As if to say, when we were promised the land of Israel and told about the 400 years, there was a fallback position. That if you can't complete the 400 years in Egypt, will I have something else to take its place? As we will soon see, each one of these four kingdoms has played a unique role in the spiritual perfection of the Jewish people. What's interesting to note is the way that they are described in the Medrash, which you have in your handout on the first page. The Torah is understood on different levels. One of them is Drash, or Midrash, which is a deeper level, not the simple meaning, which is also true, but another level of meaning. According to the Midrash, and this is actually quoted in Rashi in the beginning of Chumash, the world was created for the Jewish people. Meaning to say that the purpose of the creation of the world is for human evolution. That people should rise and transcend above their coarse humanity and become one with God. Yisroel, the Jewish people who entered a covenant with God to live such a life, to aim for such a goal, is what the world is all about. And on that level, it's understood, and we're going to begin the Midrash now, that the earth, the evolution of the earth, and how it came to be shrouded in darkness and involves in turmoil, in chaos, is really an analogy to the Jewish people. And finally, when it says, "Let there be light," is a parable, analogy to the light at the end of Jewish history at the time of Moshiach. Vayehi or, let there be light, is Oro Shel Moshiach, is the light of Moshiach. Till we get there, we are shrouded in darkness. And every stage of this darkness refers to another foreign power that has created this darkness amongst the Jewish people. And here, if you begin on page, on the first page of your handout, this is the Medrash. Rav Shimon ben Lakish explained the verses, the first verses of Genesis, to refer to the four Jewish exiles. The earth was void refers to the exile of Babylon, the first one. And empty refers to the exile of Media. Media and Persia are synonymous, is the second one. Darkness refers to the exile of Greece. And the deep waters refers to the kingdom of Rome, which they're deep. We don't see the end of Roman domination. We see another facet here. Not only is the Torah telling us and predicting future Jewish history, and we often wonder why the Jews, why have the Jews suffered? Why have we gone through so much? From the Medrash, it looks that it was part of the original plan. It's part of our evolution. But also we see Greece is referred to in terms of darkness. Not that they themselves are dark. As we're going to see, there is much light coming from Greece. But they have darkened us. They have shrouded us with darkness because of their decrees, and particularly, and which we'll see that comes up time and again in the Medrash, the decree the Jews were required to write on the horns of their oxen. And according to Maimonides, Rambam, on their clothing, on their possession, they are no longer Jews. We have no portion in the God of Israel. They were forced to give up their allegiance to Judaism. They were not dark, but they darkened us. And not only is the original creation story used as an analogy to future Jewish history, but even the world, as we say in the next citation, as the Torah describes the four rivers and the four civilizations that grew up besides these rivers, each one again refers to one of the four kingdoms that has enslaved us, or as an analogy to these four kingdoms that have enslaved us. The four rivers are the Pishon, this is the Gihon, this is Chidekel and Pros. The Pishon, is a question of what it refers to, was Sovev Eretz HaChavila, went around the land of Chavila, and over in the land of Chavila, by the banks of the river, there was gold or precious stones. This is a kingdom which represents wealth, splendor, and power. The next kingdom is the kingdom of Cush. Cush, at least in terms of symbolically, represents the Ethiopians, represents the sensuous part of life, the sensuous, the idea of feeling the good, the physical pleasures of life. So one represents wealth, the other represents physical pleasure. The Chidekel is the Tigris. And according to the Medrash, it represents, it's a fast-flowing river. It's sharp. And again, it's represented by its sharpness. And again, the decrees that it wrote, because of that sharpness, Jews have to give up their Judaism. Rome is considered, is represented by the Euphrates. It borders Israel. It's a river that overflows. It's Pora Verova. There's no end to Rome. But Rome is built on the shoulders, it stands on the shoulders of Greece. And this ends that really is a continuation of Greece. Its laws, its etiquette, its writing, its language were all based on the Greeks. And therefore, understanding Rome and our own modern predicament, it's important to understand Greece. It's a continuum. Here we're dealing now with four civilizations. We're dealing with four powers that have ruined our lives. I continue on page 2 to understand Greece by itself. Here we dealt with what Greece is part of the four powers. What is Greece by itself? Greece, the analogy in the Medrash is one, it's bright. It's like the sun. It's bright. Brightness is also associated with leprosy. The signs of the sickness are a bright spot of skin. It's bright, but it's sick. This is also Greece. And again, the illusion of riding on the horn of an ox, that we have no portion of the God of Israel. We renounce our connection to Judaism. So it's bright, it's white, and in paragraph C, it's brazen. there's a dream which is described that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had, describing future world history. And the analogy of that dream, there was a statue that was made up of different layers. The gold of the statue, the head of that statue, refers to Babylon. The next part, silver, refers to Media, Persia, Media being synonymous. Copper or brass refers to Greece. They're brazen. They have chutzpah. And of course, again, the end, we find the... Our relationship to Greece is not only in the creation story, and not only in the story that created the civilizations, but our own particular covenant we have with God, Greece is alluded to. And again, when this original bris, the bris ben abesorim, the parts of the animals that were placed in a way that the Shekhinah, the divine presence, went through them, the Abraham was shrouded in horror, in darkness. He saw the future of the Jewish people, what they will have to go through to get this land. And again, there's this allusion to the Greeks. What does this all represent? I've spoken up until now basically in riddles. I've spoken about four powers and four civilizations and how they made our lives miserable and confusing. He spoke about darkness. What does this all mean? And what does it mean to us today? On top of page 4, I quote a saying from Pirkei Avos. It's very important. It's basic to our understanding of Judaism. Rabbi Eliezer HaKapper Omer, Hakino v'hataiva v'hakovod motzinus ha'odom min ha'olam. Rabbi Eliezer HaKapper said, jealousy, lust, and glory remove a person from the world. According to the Mishnah, there are three primary desires that move all of us. They move us so far that we don't watch ourselves or remove us from this world. And they probably would best be described with three P's. The first P is power. It's the jealousy. It's power. The next P is pleasure. And the third P is pride. And they all represent a different parts of our personality. And each one is a very powerful drive. The P of pleasure is described in great detail by Freud and all those who followed his school of thought. The P of power and pride was described very well by Alfred Adler, one of the disciples of Freud who broke away. He's the author of the phrase inferiority complex. This, the next two P's. And basically says we all suffer from these three P's. Those three P's are the source of what we call the three primary cardinal sins we have in the next, on page 4 in paragraph E. Following the D is E. This is how the Maharal of Prague explains this. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of three evil things. Idolatry, immorality, bloodshed. You notice the order. Same. The Maharal explains that order represents, is really corresponds to the order of the first statement of jealousy, lust, and glory, kina, tiv, and kovet. Why do people worship idols? Why do people, I mean, for various reasons, turn to religion? I mean, there may be, I'm saying, besides the pure motivation. It's very hard trying to get a handle in our lives. We feel powerless. this is happening to us and that's happening to us. We have problems with our livelihood, and problems in the family, problems with our children, problems with health. I want to get a handle on all of this. Do you want to feel in control? There are two ways to go. It's like you go to a doctor and he says, I'll take care of all of your problems, but you have to follow all my instructions to the T. That's everything. I'm telling you have to do this and you have to do that and you have to do the other thing. And he looks at this whole regimen and he says, you know, can I get a second opinion? You know, that's the first one is Judaism. It's basically you give your life over to God. And he says, I'll take care of you. But, you know, I want you to follow the regimen and I'll do the rest. There's another method. It's a lot easier. It's really, that's Avodah Zorah. That's idolatry. There are many gods. There are many different ways. And it's a means of really, they're not great demands on you. A little money, a little this, a little that. But you can harness the forces of nature on your side. And thereby you get control. Because you don't want to lose control on your life. You want to exercise control. Idolatry, it's a form of getting control of your life. It's chaotic out there. But if you go to this place and you go to that place and you're counting your prayer beads all the time and you're knocking on wood and you're doing this and you're getting control of your life. At least that's what you think. That's kina. The idea of kina is power and control. This is Arias, Gilui Arias, immorality, of course, corresponds to lust, clearly. The Maral explains that pride corresponds to bloodshed or murder. And he explains it thus. Why do we, by what means, there's an urge within every single one of us to feel like a somebody. No one wants to feel like a nobody. Everyone wants to feel important. But why are we important? In a competitive world, we're often taught that we have to feel important because we do important things. I'm a somebody because I do this or I do that. As we're going to see, the whole idea of competition is Greek. Go for the gold. This is Greek. The whole idea of competitive sports is Greek. The idea of climbing a mountain because it's there. Now, this is Sir Edmund Hillary. Said when he was the first one known in history to have climbed to the peak of Mount Everest after climbing numerous other mountains, because it's there. If I can succeed, I've convinced myself I'm a somebody. And if I don't win, I'm a nobody. So my sense of worth is determined by where is my place in the hierarchy of life. If I'm a star, I'm a somebody. If I excel in this, I'm a somebody. If you're just anybody, you're a nobody. In the Jewish view, is that there's only really one somebody in life, and that's God. And since we're all connected to God, we are all somebodies. But to the extent that you have a relationship to the somebody, you're a somebody. We have a office called the Presidency of the United States of America. Now, there may be different opinions in this room if the president is truly a somebody or a nobody. But by the fact is, he has that office. When he has the office, he is a somebody. And a very important somebody. Now, around the president, he has zillions of people to do his bidding. You know, the ones who change the money, you know what I mean? One who launder the fund. They're very important people who deal with in the Oval Office. And as long as they have a relationship with that man, they are important. You think of Chas v'Chalila, the Democrats, when one of the great prods in political campaigns, and why people really are out there, you know, really campaigning and handing out the buttons and getting people the vote, is because if they are driven out of power, then a whole new group of people comes in and they are without jobs. And many of these people really are not employable, you know. So you are a somebody by being close to a somebody. And this is really an idea that Rashi quotes. This is a Medrash, this is a Gemara, this is a Gemara in Shavuos, a Mem Zayin, a Mem Beis. But there is a notion that you are a somebody by being close to a somebody. In Judaism, there's really only one somebody, and it's not President Clinton. This is Hashem. And to the extent that you're close to Hashem, you're a somebody. We are all close to Hashem on one level. We are people. We are neshamas. We're B'Tselem Elokim. We're in the image of God. There's a special relationship, though, being a Jew. It's a covenantal relationship. We've entered a covenant. In a sense, we've entered this covenant, this pact. We are God's ally. We are part of we are an employee, so to speak, of God. And in that sense, there is an Elokei Yisrael, there's a God of Israel. We have a unique relationship, and that determines our chashivus, our worth. Not because we can climb mountains, you know, not that we can slam dunk, or that we can hit so many home runs or pitch so many strikeouts. Says we are worth just because what we are. That's the Jewish view. If, in that sense, though, every human being, whether he be a Jew or a non-Jew, is choshev, is important. Every person is B'Tselem Elokim. Killing another human being is a statement, this person is not important. He's a nobody. I mean, after all, he'd be somebody, we need him. So he's expendable. So he's a nobody. That view that there are somebodies and nobodies goes against the whole idea of what importance, what human importance is. If a person could kill another human being, basically saying that person is worthless, his life is worthless. It's really a statement, therefore, then why are you worth something? Well, if he's worthless, what claim to fame do you have? And it could only be, well, you know, because I'm a somebody. I look at my accomplishments. I'll give you my curriculum vitae. He says, I'll give him my I'll show you what I do. And he's a nobody. So you could only kill because you've determined what worth is. But if truly worth is determined by the fact that you are and not what you do, then you wouldn't. It would be impossible to kill another human being. This is about in terms of you're required to give up your life. If someone tells you, you kill that person or I kill you, so that's how the Gemara says, M'sochem, M'chofei on the Beis, in 25b, M'sochem, he says, is your blood or redder than his? And therefore, the idea of what human worth is really basic to our understanding of ourselves and what are the whole idea of human dynamics. Let me just repeat all of this. I know it was a big thing to swallow in one gulp here. We describe that there are three primary forces that motivate us. We call the three P's. Power, pleasure, pride. Those three P's translate themselves into three cardinal sins. Power is idolatry. Because you want to channel all these forces, and instead of giving up power to God and God take over your life, basically what you're doing is you say, well, you're manipulating this, that, and everything. Money could also be a form of idolatry in that sense. But it's idolatry, it's power. Pleasure, of course, as Gilead Arias says, immorality. Says, and glory, this pride, is really the source of bloodshed. It comes the same thing. I mean, just understanding this, embarrassing another person in public is a form of bloodshed. And in this way, you could understand it a lot better. Because basically, you're telling the person you're a nobody. You're humiliating the person in public. You're a nobody. Well, says you're a nobody. Says, I'm a somebody. Which is indicative, therefore, of how you define yourself. Not only is a person who embarrasses another one in public has no portion in the world to come. The Gemara says, "Hamiskabed b'kolon chavera." The person who gets honor by the disgrace of somebody else is also, this is considered a grievous sin, has no portion in the world to come. It's this idea of hierarchy. So we've discussed the three P's. We've translated these three P's into the three cardinal sins. We are now going to translate those three P's into world history. Babylon and the Babylonian philosophy that was personified, the Nebuchadnezzar, represented power. He wanted to conquer the world, Nebuchadnezzar. He wanted power. The world wasn't big enough. It says he was such an imposing person. There's a Gemara in Shabbos that says, and I don't know if it's to be taken literally or not, when he died and went down to Gehenna and went down to hell, they were all afraid of him also. He was such an imposing person. He was the personification of power. That's Babylon. The next P, first P is power, right? Next P is pleasure, same order. That represented Ahasuerus, the Persians, the one who had this harem of all these women, who, according to the Maharal explains, amassed all these taxes so he could have all these parties. Nebuchadnezzar had all this money, didn't have all these parties. He just wanted the power. Ahasuerus wanted the pleasure. So for pleasure, it costs guilt, and you need money for pleasure. So he taxed everyone to death. He took their women against their will. All for his pleasure. The Greeks represent pride. Alexander the Great conquered the world because it was there. It's just busy conquering. And that's really Greek. That's the Olympic Games. He went for the gold, literally. This is Greece. Again, we had the three P's, the three cardinal sins, and in the same order, the three kingdoms, which come in that same order, power, pleasure, and pride, all represent all these three human failings. And now we could better understand the idea of why the Jews were exiled, because of those three cardinal sins. Because they had those three failings, they had to be exiled under the domination of these people as a form of atonement and a form of better understanding that they should change. Jews who are occupied in power, when they are plundered themselves and their assets are taken away from them, the Jews who are busy worshiping idols so they can get a better control of their life instead of handing their life over to God are handed over totally to someone who just uses them and brutalizes them. Under such circumstances, you have a different view of power. If you are the chattel of someone who's just interested in accumulating power, you have a different view of power. If you are the chattel that are used just for the pleasure of others, as it occurred by Ahasuerus, if these women are taken by force and people are just used and their money is used just to entertain others, you have a different view of entertainment. And if you are the product of someone who wants to feel that he has to show how glorious he is, and how capable it is, how worthy it is, and he has to crush you just to show it, you have a different view, since you are the recipient of all of this, you get a different view of what pride is, and what worth is, and you begin to change your philosophy of life. You know, it's very interesting. We're speaking about Greece. And we think of Greece, we think of poetry, we think of culture, their art and their sculpture. And in a certain sense, Germany was a modern-day Greece. This was the land that created Goethe and Schiller. This was the land that was from Austria and Germany. You had Mozart and Beethoven. And yet, as when they were going through the gas chambers or being processed in Auschwitz, they enslaved these Jewish musicians who had spent their lives mastering the works, the great works of Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms, and they were playing music just to further this whole process. As a musician, as a person who would be part of this, I would think afterwards you'd have a different view of German music. Or music in general. And I think that sense is what our experience with these four foreign powers changed us to such an extent that even though we were enslaved nonstop from the time of before the destruction of the first temple, after the victory of the Maccabees, there was a period where we were totally free. We had at least partially learned our lesson. And then a fourth power came. That fourth power was Rome. And Rome had all the ills of the first three powers. It was a real doozy, this Rome. And it had an extra one as well. According to Jewish tradition, the Romans are partially descended from Esau, from Edom. This is the brother, the rival of Jacob, of Yaakov. And the hatred that Esau had to Yaakov came through to his children as well. Let's see. There's this midrashic statement, Halacha says Esau son of Yaakov. It's something which is a law. It's a natural law. Esau, the two brothers, the older brother hates Yaakov. And therefore we have a kingdom that not only has all these failings, but hates Jews. And perhaps we could understand a little better that when Jews started hating themselves, the second temple was destroyed. The second temple was destroyed because of sinas chinam, because hatred of one Jew to another that was not warranted. And really, this comes really perhaps now to a better understanding of the dynamics of the four exiles. We suffer by these people because we ourselves have failings. In a sense, we let them in. Because in a certain sense, there's a little bit of them in us. So we have to get the full dosage to really appreciate how bad it is. We have a little pride, he sends us the Babylonians in the Nebuchadnezzar. We have a little urge for pleasure, he sends us the Persians in Achashverosh. We have this pride and this insensitivity to human death and the idea of this false sense of our worth. He sends us the Greeks. And once we start hating other Jews, he sends us the Romans. It's very interesting, even before the Nazis came to power, especially in Germany, how assimilated Jews really had a disdain for other Jews. And how the cultured Western Jews had this disdain for the Ostjuden, the Eastern European Jew. When you start hating other Jews, you have to get the face of what it is to taste Jewish hatred. I think after they began to feel this is how terrible it is to be the object of this anti-Semitism, I think you have a different appreciation of what a Jew is. These are the dynamics of what has happened to us in Jewish history. And now using that as a backdrop, again, let me just quote, we have the three P's, and these three P's translate, this is pride, this is pleasure and power, translate themselves into the three cardinal sins, which translate themselves into these three world powers, and plus we have the fourth, which not only has the Rome, which has not only these three, but has this hatred of Jews. I'd like to add another idea into this, which comes really into the next segment. Why were the Greeks interested in depriving us of our Judaism? The Babylonians were not, the Persians were not, the Greeks were not until the final years of Greek domination under Antiochus. They left us alone, basically. And it really comes down to two basic ideas. The first basic idea is, as we said before, there's a distinction between how we define our worth and how the Greeks define their worth. They define their worth in terms of their accomplishments, in terms of their intelligence. We define our worth in terms of our relationship with God. The Jews, when the Greeks, and they know the Jews are very stubborn people. If anyone has any doubts, well, the Jews are extremely stubborn. And it was a tremendous challenge to them to bring the Jews to their knees. It takes tremendous chutzpah because the Jews are very fierce and very obstinate not to let themselves be deprived of Judaism. Tremendous challenge. So on one hand, we had the Jews were an Everest to climb, to force the Jews to give up the Torah. On the other hand, we have the idea that the Jews represented an ideology that was truly the antithesis of Greek ideology. Their worth is their relationship, and it's a special relationship they have with God, which takes us now to section 3, the Oral Torah. This is on page 4. We know that there are actually two Torahs, the written Torah, the Torah that's in the scroll that's in the Aron Kodesh and the Ark, and there's the Oral Torah. The Oral Torah, which at least much of it was written down in the Talmud and its commentaries, which you have this whole, all these bookshelves here. The nations of the world view the Bible as part of their heritage. This is part of the great works of human literature. The Talmud is uniquely Jewish, not only because of its contents, but up until the close to the year 500, it was all oral. They couldn't access it. It was inaccessible. It was uniquely Jewish. And there's a special covenant. The covenant between God and the Jewish people is not only you're the Jewish people and you have to keep the Torah, but you have to preserve the oral tradition, the oral law. Because the idea of a covenant is the idea of this special relationship. The Greeks wanted to destroy that relationship. That's why it's understood that they were so keen on page 5 on translating the Torah. Unfortunately, it's like when one takes medicine. What's good for one part of the body very often is not good for another. And when you take medicine to heal one problem, perhaps sometimes it creates other problems. Golus, the idea of the purification, of being under these people, and learning not to be like them, often has its casualties. Because there are people who say, you know, that it's better not to keep on fighting, but rather to join. And these were the Sadducees, these were the Tzedukim. These were the assimilated Jews of those times. They wanted to tailor Judaism with Greek thought. And in that sense, and again, the time does not allow to go through all these notes. This is yours to take home, and it's worthwhile to read on your own. But I'd like to turn to page 6 just to explain what the Sadducees believed in. And at these people, at least before the Hanukkah story and after the Hanukkah story, were practicing Jews. But that was only Jews in practice. But their belief system is very different than traditional Judaism. And this is how Josephus, who was a contemporary of the Sadducees, knew them well, describes them. They take away fate entirely and suppose that God is not concerned in our doing or not doing. And they say, says that, that to act what is good or what is evil is a man's own choice. And that one or the other belongs to everyone. They may act as they please. In other words, really, God doesn't care. You can do what you want. They also take away the belief of the immortal duration of the soul and the punishments and rewards in Hades and Gehenna. They really, even though they have to give lip service to the idea that there's a God, because how did was the world created? How did the world come? They basically said, God doesn't care about us. And really, there's no afterlife. They basically assimilated, even though they may have outwardly says, acted as Jews, inwardly they were assimilated Greeks. Their whole view of life is Greek. And they behaved like Greeks. I mean, not the, I guess, the less behaved Greeks. As he says in bold type, the behavior of the Sadducees one towards the other is in some degree wild, and their conversations with those that are of their own party is as barbarous as if they were strangers to them. In other words, we would call them Vildachias. But there was a group that was influenced by the Greeks. In other words, our experience is that we are amongst them to push them away. And this other thing is to understand it's so meous, it's so disgusting, that one turns, it's just as you have a magnet. It says that you have two of them, or two positive magnets, you put them together and they just pull apart. Unfortunately, some are attracted. These are the casualties of Gullus, of the exile. We go on to explain. You can take a look at it, and I just want to quote the bold type here. At the same time that this ideology was forming, there were political changes. That a group of assimilated Jews became very powerful. And this was Yosef Ben Tovia on page 6, and I have in the bold type. You know, this is circa the year 225 before the Common Era. By this means, he gathered great wealth together, made vast gains by farming of the taxes. He became the tax collector. He had to pay the government so much, and he collected, you know, his profit margin was he owed the government so much, he bids, he has to pay the government so much. He charged more, and that was his profit margin. And he made use of what estate he had thus gotten in order to support his authority. In other words, like every good businessman, he plowed his profits back into the business and made himself more powerful. And he developed a whole class of Jews. When he was getting older and he was giving power to his other children, one of his younger children was very, very talented. Unfortunately, he was a spendthrift. And his father wanted, just in good mafia tradition, wanted to kill him. And the other brothers went out to kill their younger brother. Again, this is very Greek. As we said, bloodshed and Greece are synonymous. They were not successful, but they began to take sides. The younger brother had his allies. The older brothers had their allies. As on page 7, we describe really the coming apart of the Jewish people. And this is right before the Hanukkah story. It was in this, under these circumstances, where we had a growing body of Greek Jews who outwardly acted like Jews because that was because of public peer pressure, but inwardly were really assimilated, that we have the incident which was recorded on page 7, this is in section 5, the Hellenists. where Jason, a brother of the current Kohen Gadol high priest, went to Antiochus, the villain of the Hanukkah story. This is approximately the year 175 before the Common Era, and bought the position of high priest. A few years later, somebody else outbidded him, as you say in section B, and took it from him. So we had really, and here they started, it was these Jews who started the wholesale assimilation. We often think as just the Greeks are the villains in Antiochus. The true story is that it was really Jews who undermined all of this. And in fact, here on page 8, we describe when Antiochus finally first comes. He came really to support one of these. There was a civil war between these two parties. He came to support Menelaus, the last one who bought the position. He pillaged the temple, you know, took the menorah. That's why they had to make the miracle of menorah. I mean, he took the menorah. He created a fortress there, which the assimilated Jews found. In other words, that they had a base of power. And it was really from that base that they made all the tsaros. Finally, after the victory of Hanukkah, and after there was a change of the guard, and Antiochus died and his son took power, Lysias, on page 9, the advisor to the king, to Antiochus' son, Antiochus V now, says, Lysias advised, you have the bold type, advised the king to slay Menelaus. This is the high priest. And this gives you an idea of what was the real story behind Hanukkah. And this is quoted in Josephus. This is 12th book, and this is in chapter 9, this is paragraph 7. If he would have the Jews be quiet, like this, and cause him this is no further disturbance. In other words, he advised, you know, if you kill Menelaus, they'll stop revolting and they'll be fine. For that man, Menelaus, this assimilated Jew, was the origin of all the mischief the Jews had done them by persuading his father to compel the Jews to leave the religion of their fathers. In other words, it wasn't just the Greeks, it was assimilated Jews. Once the Greeks had, you know, they had a field day. I mean, they loved to be invited. It was a tremendous challenge for them. It was like it was climbing Mount Everest, and they didn't feel too well being defeated. You know, it's nice. You know, there are people says at the Olympic Games. You know, they if you've ever noticed, you know, they take the winners on the winner's stand, and there's the gold medal winner, and there's a silver medal, there's a bronze medal. So the silver and the bronze, nunu, but the ones who don't get anything, says it's tutve, you know, says you're a loser. He went and you lost. They don't like being losers. And they took it out on their enemies. The whole story, we often think of the Hanukkah miracle as that was the victory and that was that. It took almost 30 years for complete victory to be at hand. And then for them to be totally independent. And they keep the story as I have in the bold type. And again, this is time doesn't allow really to go through this in detail. But time and again, the assimilated Jews asked the Greek powers, come in and save us. And they kept on time and again, they came in because they were asked. And in fact, again, it says, it's next to the last paragraph. It's on page 9. This is in bold type underlined. This is Bacchides, another general of another Greek king. And he was very angry with the men who disregarded the law, in other words, the assimilated Jews, who advised them to come into the country. And he killed many of them, resolved to go back to his country, and he made peace with the Maccabees. Again, just showing this idea that it was the assimilated Jews who let them in. We have struggles with the Greeks of our day. The lesson of the Hanukkah story is that if we let them in, we really have tsaros. We really have problems. You know, it's said, there's a beautiful story, I don't know if we've mentioned it in the classes here. The Hanukkah story is a flip side of that story. There's a beautiful story that according to one version, is printed in the Talmud, the emperor, the Roman emperor asked Rabbi Tanchuma, he says, every time there's a shul and there's a minyan, the Shekhinah is there, the divine presence is there. I don't know how many shuls there are in Detroit. If you picked all the shuls in the world, there's zillions of them. He says, how many Shekhinahs are there? You know, it can't be everywhere. You know, you think by Elio HaNovi by the Seder night. You know, where is he? You know? He says, it can't be everywhere. He says, how many Shekhinahs are there? So he explained, he says, very dramatically, but he explained, says, that the Shekhinah is like the sun. Sun shines everywhere, but we have shutters in our windows. If we open the shutters, the light goes through. If we keep it shut, no light. When it says the Shekhinah is everywhere, the divine light shines through because we let it in. Normally, we have shutters. It's not that it transferred here. The Shekhinah is all over, but we have these shutters. When we let it in, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, comes in. In the same sense, the Greeks are all over. But if we don't invite them in, you know, it's like you have children, and it's tough. You see, the children are growing up in a neighborhood, and there's a lot of bad kids in the neighborhood. You know, and sometimes you have to walk. You know, there's a whole gang of these kids. You know, it's very unpleasant. But one thing, you're never sure, but one thing is, if you don't start calling them names, you're in a much better position, says, than if you go over there and starting up with this whole gang of kids, you know? If you just walk and mind your business, it's like with dealing with dogs, you know? You're in a much stronger position. That really is the story of our relationship with the Greeks, or all of those in our history. When we want to become their best friends, we want to bring them into our own homes, then we have the tsaros. And really, if we look, this is our recent history with Germany. At least in the land of Germany. It's to the German, who the Germans were the most assimilated of all Jews, the most cultured, the most well-educated, the highest percentage, I mean, way beyond their numbers of doctors and lawyers and university professors, artists, writers. But that's the lesson of our Golus. You know? To the extent is that we let them in, we really have to be taught the lesson. And if we have our own, if we march the beat of a different drummer, and we keep the values of Elokei Yisrael, of the covenant, we have a special protection. And speaking about this Shekhinah, we can now better understand the idea of the miracle of Hanukkah. We described before as the Greeks having light. They have plenty of light. But they make our eyes darkened. Because there's our light and there's their light. And they really can't. The light, I don't mean the light of science or understanding. That's not Greek. That's their contributions to humanity. There's the uniquely Greek way of looking at the world, which is who I am and what defines me and my worth. If I am defined by my culture and my education or my sports ability, that's Greek. If I am defined by my spirituality, by my relationship to God, that's Jewish. They wanted to darken our eyes to take the light of the Shekhinah, the Jewish light, away from us and substitute their light. Some years ago, there was a beautiful cartoon that was made in a kibbutz in Israel. And it was called The Lights. I don't know if anyone has seen this. It is really recommended. What they did was, I mean, very symbolically, is what they wanted to do, the Greeks, is take away the Jewish light. You know, this light. And the light was represented the same light of the letters from Sinai. You know, it came out, you know, when Mount Sinai was. These flashing, dancing, you know, lights, these fires of the osius of the letters of the Torah. And that was the same light on the menorah, which really represents the Shekhinah, the divine presence. They wanted to replace those lights, those Jewish letters, with Greek letters. And there were these clunky metallic letters, you know. You don't need those letters, you know what you like. You need these letters. Those are harsh and clunky, you know, and it was very cutely made. It's a cartoon. And really, the dynamics and the struggle and the victory was really whose letters won out. The one of truly light or the clunky ones, you know. And that really is really the story of Hanukkah. You know, one of the major, one of the great questions that are asked. We know the Talmud relates the story of the light, the miracle of the lights, and so we light the Hanukkah candles. Yet in the davening, we really don't make much mention of the lights, of at least the miracle of lights. We describe, turn to page 10 of the handout, how the Greeks made these decrees that we should forget the Torah. They compelled us to not observe the mitzvahs. Finally, we were victorious. We went into the temple. We cleansed it out. And we lighted lights in the courtyards of your sanctuary or of your holiness and established 8 days of Hanukkah. It's not clear what the significance of the kindled lights is, but there's no mention of any miracle. It's just what we did. We cleaned it out. We lit lights. And there are many different approaches to this problem. And with what I've said through this class, I'd like to approach them perhaps in a different way. As we said, there are two lights. There's a light of Greece, and there's a light. There's the Jewish light, the light of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, the light of the Torah. We speak of the miracle of Hanukkah. Actually, the Talmud teaches us, there's more in Shabbos here, which we quote in the bottom page 10, Chov Beis Omer Beis in 22b, there was a constant miracle every day, at least when the Jews merited it. This is in the menorah, in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. They had the mitzvah was to light before sunset each one of these lamps, and it contained enough light oil to light through the night, and it would automatically extinguish in the morning. It would just finish. One lamp, even though it had the exact same amount of oil as all the other lamps, lit for 24 hours, just, you know, akin to the Hanukkah miracle, and it happened every single day. And it was a sign to the Jewish people that the Shekhinah is still there. It's the symbol of light. The light, the lamp is the soul, the lamp is spirituality. This was the symbolic, I'm here. When Antiochus, basically he was invited in. When we lost the light inside of us, the light was taken away from the temple. When we had the victory was not simply that the decrees were annulled, but that the Shekhinah that had disappeared from the Jewish people had returned. That's part of the celebration. You know, often you have situations where you have a partner, where you have a business relationship or a social relationship, and you get into a fight. Sometimes there's hard feelings and bad words, and sometimes you don't speak to each other for years, and finally maybe you get together and you finally make up. But it's not the same. You know, the relationships are civil now, but it's not the same. There's strain in the relationship. It's like you're strangers. There's another level, though, when you make up and things are just as they were before. The Jews had basically lost the divine presence within them because they had absorbed Greece within them. And this was the Tzedukim, this was the Sadducees, and this is this whole group of powerful Jews that were infiltrating the body of Jewry. once the Jews lost it amongst themselves, then inevitably the Tsoros happened. You don't want it? Well, make sure you don't have it. And they made there was a decree not to study Torah and decrees not to do the mitzvahs. It's only afterwards that they, after the revolution, says that not only were the Greeks defeated and they stopped with this coercion, but that the Shekhinah itself came back. And that was the sign of the miracle of Hanukkah. The fact is it lit the 8 days without enough oil was a sign of, I'm back home. Things are okay. Don't worry. In the temple, we speak about the miracle of that one lamp. That there were seven lamps that were lit normally. The candelabra menorah had seven lamps. One lit, for 24 hours. There were other miracles with the menorah. On page 11, on the first paragraph, it deals with one time there was an event. They didn't have oil that had burned for a year. But after the second part of that paragraph, our sages said, when they lit the menorah, every courtyard that was in Yerushalayim, that was in Jerusalem, was using its light. It was the light of the menorah was so intense, way beyond what you'd normally expect on what olive oil would do, which would really just light up a room. This lit up the city. That was part of the miracle. And the language is Chatzros Yerushalayim. This is the Medrash in the Medrash Tanchum Parshas Tetzava. Every courtyard in Yerushalayim. I believe when we say in the Al HaNisim prayer, V'hidliku Neros, it starts off Acha Kim Bova Nechalid V'Beisecha. Your children here. You're on page 10. It says the in English translation here. They came to the Holy of Holies. And then they went, cleanse your temple. In other words, got rid of the idols from the actual sanctuary. The temple itself was built as a courtyard which surrounded a large building. The building was the Heichal. The Devir was really the Heichal. This was divided up the building into two parts. The Holy of Holies, which the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, went once a year, and the Heichal, the regular sanctuary. They went up until the Holy of Holies, saw that the Greeks hadn't disturbed that. They took out the idols out of the Heichal Kodshecha, out of the sanctuary itself. They went into the temple courtyard. And they really had to build, it had been used for 3 years as a pagan temple. They had to dismantle the old altar and build a new altar. That's what we speak about the song Motzur, about Chanukah Samizbeach, about dedicating the altar because they had to build a new altar. So we went from the inner sanctum to the sanctuary to the courtyard. What is now, it says, Evedliku Neros, they kindle light in the courtyards of your sanctuary. Where are the courtyards? So I believe what it's saying is that it's referring to the Ner of the menorah, the light of the menorah itself. But it was so intense that it lit up not only where it was, but as the Medrash says, all the courtyards of Yerushalayim. Which was indicative, therefore, it's hinted at in the prayer. It says that the lighting itself was back, let's say, to normal. In other words, the miracle, the standard miracle that always occurred with the lights of the menorah was occurring now, which was indicative not only had they cleansed the temple, but made it a place fit for the divine presence, and that it came back. And that's really what we're celebrating. The Chanukah, the dedication of the house, is a celebration. Not only are the Goyims no longer harassing us, but our relationship to God, to Hashem, is back where it was. So we have not only rid ourselves of the Greeks, but we have embraced Elokei Yisrael, the God of the Jews. The divine presence is back. That's what the miracle is. And I'd like to end now with an important lesson for today. We began with the Medrash that the Greeks symbolized the idea of azus, of chutzpah. You know, they're brazen, they're brass, that's their metal. They're bright. It took the chutzpah of the Greeks to try to make the attempt to take Judaism away from Jews. Who were the ones who countered them? Who were the ones who fought them? And this was Mattathias, one of the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, who were from the tribe of Levi. Levi represents chutzpah amongst the Jewish people. All Jews have chutzpah, here on page 12 in paragraph B. He says, it has to the extent where we have, the Gemara says in Be'ah, in Chofei Omid Be'ah, in 25b, if the Torah had not been given to the Jews, no nation or tongue could withstand them. They have more chutzpah than the Greeks. It's only because of the Torah they have a little bit of edelkeit, you know, that they have the refineness and the humility that they have really comes from Torah. When you take Torah away from Jews, Jews create revolutions. We quoted before in a previous lecture that when the Russian government began its legislation to assimilate the Jews, one of the great rabbis came to the minister that was in charge of this, and he says, you better be careful. He says, this is the czarist minister. Because if you're successful in taking Torah away from Jews, the Jews will create a revolution and throw all of you out. Jews are on the forefront, really, of every movement. For it was from civil rights to gay rights to animal rights to every rights. You have some Jew who's hoisting the placards and is in front of the media, espousing the cause. And amongst Jews, the ones who have the most chutzpah are Levi, or the Kohanim. They are the ones, we read in the Torah a few weeks ago, says that they are the ones who killed out, they thought of the plot that the members of the city of Shechem should all perform circumcision. They were disabled, and they went and killed them all. Yaakov says, cursing them, says, but cursed be their anger, for it was fierce. Love of God is spoken of in fierceness. In this last quote, we have him Shir HaShirim, Ki Aza Kamovis Ava, for strong till death is my love. This love is described in things of this azus, of this brazenness, of this chutzpah. Love knows no bounds. It says, it was only the Jewish people who had to counter the brazenness of the Greeks with the brazenness of Jewish chutzpah. That no power, because the idea of azus, of chutzpah, as Rashi explains in Psochem, Kufyud Beis, 12, is going beyond your limitations, which is really very Greek, the idea of pressing yourself. Remember, we said before in another class, you know, when up until Roger Bannister, was able to run a mile in less than 4 minutes, it was thought that it was humanly impossible to run a mile less than 4 minutes. It was a 4 minute mile. This is the once he ran the 4 minute mile, many, many athletes followed him and ran afterwards. But he had that sense that there's no limits. Those are the people who win, go for the gold and win the gold medals of the Olympics. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen these cartoons. I remember as a little kid, that's Felix the Cat, who would go over a cliff and would keep on walking on thin air until he finally realized in the middle of air, then he would go down. But as long as he felt he was going, he went. Because he doesn't know limitations. If you don't know limitations, you can keep on going. That's a Jewish attribute. That was a Greek attribute. The reason we won over the Greeks is we used our chutzpah to a very positive end, and we were able to combat their fierceness. But this azus is used on a day-to-day basis, not in a way of killing people, chas v'shalom, or the brazenness you have in front of the media. But there is a very subtle form of azus with the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch speaks of in the very beginning that you should be, the quotes from Ovos, and then the end of the fifth parak, Az Kanomer, one should be brazen like a leopard. And he explains, based on that, the Ramah, explains that one should have the strength of character, that even though there are those who laugh at you, ridicule you, if you have your own sense, if you have your values, you should have that strength of character to keep on going and doing what you feel is right, even though you have the pressure from the community at large. That's the kind of Jewish azus, the Jewish chutzpah, that we have to use. And it's especially, says, it's the kind of azus that we use where we're in golus. We spoke about the four kingdoms, and each one again represented a different power. Right? This is pride was Bavel, says, or power was Bavel, says, and pleasure was Persia. Pride is Greece. All three plus Jewish hatred is Rome. The power that we don't assimilate their views and therefore succumb to their pressure, and succumb like the Germans succumbed, or like the Jews succumbed at the time of Hanukkah, is that we have to use our resource of Jewish chutzpah. The chutzpah not in your face is the chutzpah but the chutzpah to have the quiet strength of character says, I have my own, I have a culture that goes back for some 4,000 years. And I have a covenant of a Torah that goes back for more than 3,000 years. I don't have to be pressured and feel inferior just because I follow the dictates of my consciousness, and rather than what the current fad of today. That I believe is the lesson that we learned from all of this, and is a lesson of Hanukkah. We are placed in amongst the nations for a positive purpose. It's to test us. It's to challenge us. It's to show that if we have the mettle to withstand all that pressure, and if we do, then just as in Hanukkah, that pressure will disappear.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.